Heard arguments Friday in a case challenging the NSA's mass collection of U.S. phone call data. The American Civil Liberties Union filed suit earlier this year after leaks from Edward Snowden showed Verizon Business was ordered to hand over the call records of all of its customers. The ACLU says the NSA program goes far beyond what Congress has authorized under the Patriot Act. The Republican-controlled House has approved several bills that would provide a major boon to oil and gas fracking in the United States. A measure approved Thursday would fast-track the construction of gas pipelines. That vote came one day after the House passed legislation that would strip the federal government's authority to regulate fracking in states with their own rules. Another provision would impose a $5,000 fee on anyone filing an official protest against a drilling project. The measures have little chance of Senate passage, and President Obama's already threatened a veto should they reach his desk. A new study from the group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington says oil and gas industry spending on congressional campaigns in fracking states and districts has jumped 231% since 2004. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Responding to listener and community requests, we are engaging in a trial period of broadcasting the Tom Hartman Show from 4 to 5 p.m. each weekday. We take seriously the feedback we have received from listeners, non-listeners, KBOO members, and volunteers. This trial period is both an attempt to present the program, which is currently unavailable on broadcast media in the Portland area, and to solicit feedback on how appropriate this program is for KBOO. Please call 503-231-8032 or write to program@kboo.org with your opinion.
KBOO is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KBOO's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KBOO jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
The time is 5:03 and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM Community Radio. Up next is the evening news. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrill Hirsch University with 5 part-time MBA programs that combine classic business skills with an emphasis on creative thinking, ethical decision-making, and sound judgment, the hallmarks of a liberal arts perspective. December 5th, evening information session. Details can be found online at merrillhirsch.edu.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, unemployment defined at a 5-year low in the Portland metro area.
The United States House passes a big fracking giveaway bill.
And the Portland Association of Teachers rallies for their contract. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 25th, 2013. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Frances Fagan. As many as 2,000 Portlanders turned out on the Burnside Bridge to rally in support of their public school teachers last Friday evening. The Portland Association of Teachers, or PAT, and the school board had declared an impasse in contract negotiations last Wednesday, and now a strike looms. KBOO's Joe Meyer was at the rally and filed this report.
The Portland Public School Board and the Portland Association of Teachers have declared an impasse in contract negotiations. Now both sides have 7 days to submit their final contract offers and cost estimates to a mediator and 37 days to avert a strike. Here are sounds from the rally.
Proud to represent the over 3,500 PAT members at the bargaining table as we try to get a fair contract. I have dedicated my life to creating strong public schools in the city of Portland. I've been bargaining officially since 2006. I was a member of the bargaining team back at that time, and I want everyone to know this is by far the most contentious bargain I've ever been a part of. If you remember back to 2002, this is much more contentious than that time frame. And the real sad part is, there's no reason for the crisis that we're in right now. It's a false crisis that was created by the district. There is no reason that they should be looking to take away from teachers right now. Yeah. We can't accept the school board demanding that we take less. Less for our students, less for our schools, less for teachers. It's unacceptable. I hope that you all will stand with me, the rest of the bargaining team, as we try to finish this out and get a fair contract for the teachers in the city of Portland.
Here on the streets.
I'm Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
Nice to meet you, Joe.
You got time for a couple
people
questions?
People here tonight, how is that going to translate?
We started out with the size of the crowd. It's the biggest gathering since Occupy. What's that significant for in terms of bargaining?
You know, I think it shows that teachers are really supportive of what we're trying to do as a bargaining team. I think they're tired of being pushed around. They're overworked, and they're willing to stand up for what they believe in.
How does it go back to the bargaining table?
So I think at the bargaining table, you know, the issues that we bring forth and try to represent, I don't think you can ignore us.
Can you say quickly what the teachers want?
I think, you know, to put it simply, the teachers want the resources to do their job, to do it well, and to do it with reasonable workload.
And how can our listeners understand quickly that that's not what the board is offering?
Quite simply, the board is trying to create a false crisis that puts more pressure on teachers to do even more with even less.
You know, we don't want to say they don't like kids. What's going on there?
I would term their strategy is all about being able to control the work lives of teachers and have less professional teachers in the classroom with the autonomy to do the work that they are trained to do.
You also mentioned a false crisis.
So the district is in a very, very solid financial position. They found $16 million here a couple weeks ago, and they've had the PERS reform on the backs of the teachers themselves.
That was Portland Association of Teacher Negotiator Bill Wilson. He told us that the school board was invoking false austerity to squeeze our public educators.
A new report says Portland area unemployment hit a 5-year low last month. While the metro area lost 3,000 seasonally adjusted jobs, unemployment claims in October fell to 6.9%, down from 7.1% in September. Two different data sets were used in the report. A survey of household incomes says that the seasonally adjusted unemployment rate was the lowest since September 2008, the beginning of the Great Recession, the worst economic crash since the Great Depression of 1930. February 2009 saw the unemployment rate balloon to 11%, where it stayed at for nearly 1 year. It was acknowledged that the unemployment numbers for Portland were spurred by a decline in the number of adults in the labor market, a trend which is reproducing itself nationally. The underemployment rate, a more comprehensive picture of economic data that is not tracked statewide and includes those working part-time who would prefer full-time employment, puts underemployed Oregonians at 16%. Over 75,000 people are unemployed and looking for work in the five-county metro area. The statewide unemployment rate is 7.7%, while nationally unemployment stands at 7.2%.
One homeless service provider in the city of Portland will receive $1 million towards their budget next year, and organizations have until December 2nd to submit their proposals. The Portland City Council has approved a one-time payment of $1 million to a local nonprofit or service provider for homeless people. Because of a spending freeze in the 2012-2013 fiscal year, there was an unexpected budget surplus of more than $21 million, which is exactly the amount Mayor Charlie Hales demanded to be cut from the budget last June. Additionally, $300,000 will go to immediately housing 92 homeless women now living on the streets. The only groups eligible for the one-time funding are groups that have existing contracts with the city. Other criteria include a demonstrated history in helping individuals or homeless couples, people who suffer from mental illnesses, and assault or domestic violence victims. Other goals for the money are to reduce wait lists, give increased access to people of color, and to have a stronger relationship with the law enforcement agencies.
While many of us were getting our beauty sleep for the short Thanksgiving work week, Portland's finest were involved in a traffic pursuit. Just past 11 p.m. last night, Portland police attempted to stop a white Ford Probe for traffic violations at Southeast 92nd and Flavel. Instead of stopping for the officer, the coupe sped off eastward until it parked in a driveway near 162nd Avenue, where both the driver and passenger exited the car and tried to escape pursuit on foot. The Portland police claims to have received information from residents that one of the passengers was in possession of a handgun, which prompted the use of the Portland Police Air Support Unit in aid of their arrest. The driver of the vehicle was found hiding in a pond a few blocks from where he had parked the car. His passenger managed to evade arrest for another hour and a half. After police had given up on the search, area residents captured him at gunpoint and turned him in to the Clackamas police. No handgun was found in connection with either suspect. The driver was charged with reckless driving and attempting to elude arrest on foot and in a vehicle, and his passenger was taken in for an outstanding theft charge.
Software giant John McAfee has been evicted from his luxury apartment in Portland in connection with the ongoing murder investigation of his former neighbor in Belize. McAfee started his antivirus software firm in 1987 and sold the business in the early 90s. He was living in Belize until a year ago when Belizean authorities indicted him as a person of interest in the murder of his neighbor Gregory Fall. McAfee left the country after the allegations, landing in Guatemala, Miami, and then Portland earlier this year. Since moving to the city, McAfee has been busy creating a graphic novel about his life with Portland illustrator Chad Esley, among other antics such as producing a video on how to uninstall his antivirus software featuring scantily clad women. His property manager evicted him last week and took out a protective order against him. Neither McAfee nor his property manager were willing to comment on the circumstances leading to his eviction. There is a hearing on the eviction set for January 3rd. McAfee has stated he does not plan on returning to Belize.
Today, 9 insurance companies notified the Oregon Insurance Division that they will offer the option to renew current individual health plans that are not compliant with the Federal Affordable Care Act. Together, these 9 companies cover close to 100% of Oregonians who currently have private health care insurance. The plans in question are not compliant with the new Affordable Care Act, which means that they can exclude people with pre-existing conditions or raise premiums without advance notice. Two of the health insurance companies, Moda Health and Pacific Source, will allow renewals through March 31st, 2014. The other 7 will allow individuals to keep their plans through December 31st of next year. People who choose to keep their existing plans will not qualify for tax credits to lower costs through Cover Oregon. Those tax credits provide subsidies to individuals and families that significantly lower the cost of premiums. People concerned with the slow rollout of the Cover Oregon website will be able to keep their higher-cost plans through next year if they choose to do so.
Last Thursday, the Oregon Family Council, better known as the conservative Christian group responsible for Oregon's 2004 constitutional ban on gay marriage, filed a state ballot measure. The group claims this bill would protect business owners who wish to deny services to same-sex couples who are marrying. However, a comparison in the OFC that the OFC made in discussion to the proposed ballot initiative has angered local Jewish leaders. The council's spokesperson, Teresa Hark, asked the Oregonian, quote, "Would you expect a Jewish bakery to serve a neo-Nazi who wanted a cake with a swastika on it?" Unquote. End quote. A group of 18 rabbis and Jewish leaders wrote a letter to the OFC demanding an apology. In part, it reads, "It is an insult to those who perished in the Shoah, the Hebrew term for the Holocaust, to use one of history's greatest atrocities to forward your political agenda." For more on this story, KBOO's Mike Klepfer speaks to Rabbi Michael of Congregation Beth Israel, who co-signed the letter.
What's your central complaint with the Oregon Family Council's comments?
My concerns that were made by the about the statements made by the Oregon Family Council by their spokeswoman was that they, in making a statement about their concerns, they brought up a comparison to a neo-Nazi group and Jewish individuals. That bringing the Holocaust into this conversation, I find insulting. It's degrading to the memory of the Holocaust victims, 6 million Jews who were exterminated by the Nazis and who neo-Nazis support as an ideal, over 12 million individuals slaughtered by the Nazis. This is simply not appropriate to be brought into this conversation, and I think it demands an apology, public apology, by the Oregon Family Council.
It seems as though the comments were intended to evoke a sense of religious persecution. Do you think this is fair?
No, I don't think it's fair at all. I think we can take whatever position we want on the concerns that the Oregon Family Council might have, but to bring the Holocaust into this is simply to bring the entire conversation down to a level that is vastly inappropriate.
What are your views on gay marriage?
My personal views are in support of gay marriage, but the truth of the matter is, whether I was in support of it or not, these comments are simply inappropriate.
In Portland's Jewish community at large, is there a lot of support for gay marriage?
Yes, there is a lot of support for gay marriage within the Jewish community, though, again, I think that that's a separate conversation.
Yeah.
I think really the focus I want to bring here is on bringing the Holocaust into this conversation.
So you've asked for an apology from the Oregon Family Council.
Yes, and I drafted a letter which was signed by a large number of rabbis in our community and others, Jewish leaders. So this is not just a personal request, but this is coming from the leadership of the Jewish community of Oregon. And these rabbis and leaders represent most of the congregations, most of the synagogues in the state of Oregon.
Do you think an apology from the OFC is forthcoming?
I couldn't say, but certainly what I would be looking for and what the Jewish community is looking for is a real apology and not simply a statement of why this was done, but truly a recognition that to bring the Holocaust into this conversation is deeply inappropriate.
Rabbi Kahana, I want to thank you for your time and happy Hanukkah.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it very much.
That was KBOO's Mike Klepfer speaking to Rabbi Michael Kahana of Congregation Beth Israel.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation released statistical information suggesting fewer hate crimes were reported in 2012 than in 2010. Over 13,000 law enforcement agencies around the country participated in developing the data as part of the Uniform Crime Reporting Program. Oregon reported 52 incidents between 72 participating agencies, while close to 247 agencies reported close to 300 incidents in Washington. Nearly half of all 5,800 offenses were motivated by racial bias, and about 1 in 5 cases involving biases against religion and sexual orientation.
The Oregon Bureau of Land Management has released for public comment a big plan that could decide the future of a fascinating bird. The plan involves 6 alternatives for an environmental impact statement to help keep the greater sage grouse off the endangered species list. For more on this story, here is KBOO reporter Genevieve McDaniel in collaboration with Oregon News Service.
Cattlemen and conservation groups are studying possible changes to public land management in central and southeastern Oregon. 6 alternatives were released on Friday by the BLM, and the agency has to determine which will do the best job of helping the greater sage grouse rebound. Identified with letters A through F, the agency's preferred alternative is D. It caps what it calls human disturbance at 3% in areas of sage grouse habitat. Dan Morse with the Oregon National Desert Association says that raises some questions.
3% of what, essentially? We don't know how lax or how strict that provision might be. That's very important because the cap on disturbance could be quite beneficial if it were implemented properly.
He adds that alternative D doesn't say much about activities such as mining or energy development and transmission. The feds are under a court order to decide by 2015 if the bird should be listed as an endangered species. Sage grouse are dependent on sagebrush for food and shelter, and the Oregon plan is one of 15 in 10 states where they reside. Sage grouse numbers in Oregon are holding steady compared with population declines in other states. To Lake County rancher John O'Keefe, that's proof that most cattlemen are doing what they can to coexist with the birds. We caught up with O'Keefe as he was driving back from the BLM announcement in Eugene.
You know, ranchers to ranch out there in the desert need the same thing that sage grouse need. They need healthy rangeland and open space, and they need to not have the landscape taken over by fires or invasive plants.
Conservation groups think grazing can be just as much a threat to sage grouse habitat as invasive plants or wildfires. They're leaning toward the 2 alternatives that would reduce grazing on about 4 million of the 10 million acres in Oregon. The BLM will hold public meetings about the draft sage grouse plans in January in Baker City, Burns, Lakeview, Ontario, and Prineville. This is Genevieve McDaniel with KBOO News.
Senate Bill 1731, introduced by Tea Party senators last week, could threaten to endanger species. The bill requires plants and animals that are on the endangered species list to be removed every 5 years. Species taken off the list cannot be put back on until a joint resolution is passed by Congress to renew the protections they once had. The new bill would essentially undo the work of the Endangered Species Act, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. The act is to protect animals and plants that are rare and struggling to survive. They've had a nearly 100% success rate thus far. All protections for critical habitat would be eliminated if the bill is passed.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. After this newscast, stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6 and Prison Pipeline at 6:30. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather should be partly cloudy with a high temperature of 52 degrees. Tonight will be chilly with the low temperatures dropping down to 28 degrees under partially cloudy skies. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 32 counts per minute in North Portland, high of 49. Beaverton, 30 CPM, high 47. Raleigh Hills, 30 CPM, high of 45. Powell Butte, 25 CPM, high of 38. In Medford, 34 CPM with a high of 50. Olympia, Washington has a 26 CPM. Tenino, Washington, 30 CPM with a high of 50. Seattle, Washington, 31 CPM, high of 47. Bellingham, Washington, 30 CPM with a high of 48. Vancouver, BC, 25 CPM with a high of 35. Sitka, Alaska, has a 33 CPM count with a high of 47. And Kenai, Alaska, has a radiation count of 31 counts per minute with spikes up to 43. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
The time is 5:26, which means it's time now for Daily Commentary with Jim Hightower.
As we approach our annual Feast of Thanksgiving, please join me in expressing our nation's deepest, heartfelt feelings for an extra special group of America's farmers. That raspberry goes out to the 50 billionaires who've been farming the U.S. Farm Subsidy Program for years, harvesting a cornucopia of taxpayer cash for themselves or their corporate empires. The diligent watchdogs of the Environmental Working Group match their own farm subsidy database with the Forbes 400 list of richest Americans to unmask these Gucci-wearing old McDonald's. EIEIO, what a ripoff! Among the richest of these faux farmers are three Walmart heirs whose personal wealth totals $100 billion. Then there's investment huckster Charles Schwab, sitting on a $5 billion wad of wealth, yet pumping $500,000 worth of rice subsidies into his California duck hunting resort. Also, corporate takeover artist Henry Kravis, who has amassed some $5 billion in wealth, took more than $1 million from us to subsidize safflower, sunflower, and other crops raised on two of his ranches. Especially jarring is the presence of such multi-billionaire right-wingers as oil and entertainment tycoon Philip Anschutz and nuclear waste mogul Harold Simmons. They've expressed disdain for government spending on poor people and other, quote, takers, yet they've gladly taken more than $500,000 each in farm payments. Actually, the working group's tally understates the total haul by these mega-rich tillers of our public treasury. Many also harvest crop insurance subsidies, but Congress has dutifully outlawed disclosure of these names to the public, even though it's our money they receive. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, these billionaires' most profitable ag products are the Congress critters they keep in their corrals. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
The U.S. House passed a bill last week that would prevent federal enforcement of laws against fracking on federal lands. For more, KBOO's Jimmy Tardy spoke with Alex Terrell of the League of Conservative Voters and filed this report.
I'm speaking with Alex Terrell of the League of Conservation Voters in Washington, D.C. regarding a fracking bill that the United States House of Representatives just passed. Alex, tell me why this fracking bill should be of concern.
Sure. Well, so, you know, as folks know, fracking is happening in, you know, all over the country. And what the bill did last week was actually get rid of any kind of federal oversight over fracking on public lands. So, you know, a lot of Western states have a ton of public lands, like Oregon does, run by agencies like the National Forests and the Bureau of Land Management. And these guys are overseeing fracking, and, you know, this is having all sorts of impact on air pollution, on water pollution. And the House of Representatives, which is run by, you know, folks who are, you know, kind of Tea Party supporters, are trying to get rid of any kind of federal oversight over what are federal lands. And so that's going to mean a lot more pollution in places near national parks, wilderness areas. So it's going to have a big impact on places that people care about.
So this effort by the House of Representatives is just another in a long line of efforts to gut the regulatory authority of various federal institutions. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, there's just a real kind of anti-government zeal that you saw kind of hit a peak there during the government shutdown. But this is longstanding, and it's just been a kind of broad-scale assault from the Tea Party on, you know, kind of environmental protections from the EPA and the national parks and kind of everything that, my organization, League of Conservation Voters, you know, is dedicated to protecting.
And this vote was along party lines?
Pretty much, yeah. You had a couple of, crossover Democrats support the bill, but yeah, largely party line.
What is the status as far as this is concerned in the Senate?
So, you know, we want to make sure that nothing like this moves over in the Senate. At this point, we're not, you know, it's a different body over there. The Democrats control, and, you know, they're largely want to see, you know, increased protections against fracking rather than, you know, getting rid of those protections. So I think there's not a ton of prospect that this moves, but if folks want to give a call to their congressman and senator to let them know how they feel about fracking and about this particular bill, that definitely helps ensure that this bill goes nowhere.
And was this bill specifically geared toward fracking, or is it more of a general kind of limitation on these authorities?
It was really geared towards fracking here. And, you know, this has become kind of sort of a flashpoint where the oil and gas industry has been using fracking to really expand a lot of the drilling that's been happening in this country. And all of a sudden, we're drilling more than we have in the last 20 years or so. And, of course, that has all sorts of terrible impacts on public lands, on communities, on air pollution, on water pollution. Fracking involves shooting some toxic mixture of millions of gallons of water, chemicals, which are oftentimes secret, and sand. And this stuff is, in a lot of states where it's happening, very poorly regulated. And so that's why you need a federal role to make sure that there's like kind of a baseline of protection for communities. There's been an effort to make sure that we've got some stronger standards, but this is an effort from our opponents who want to take down those standards and just let the oil industry kind of run roughshod over communities and public lands.
On an aside note, I understand that you guys just recently endorsed Senator Merkley?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So he's, in terms of what we work on over here, he's just a huge, huge champ on environmental protection. So he's a guy we need to get back here.
I've been speaking with Alex Terrell about the League of Conservation Voters' stance against a bill that was passed by the United States House of Representatives intended to limit the authority of federal bodies such as the Environmental Protection Agency over the public lands and public resources of the United States. Thanks for your time, Alex.
Absolutely. Thank you.
A large piece of refinery equipment headed for Alberta, Canada, left Western Oregon today headed east. The so-called megaload, which weighed close to 5 tons, was supposed to leave yesterday and is expected to meet with protests as it crosses the Nez Perce tribal land. Because Oregon rules only permit a load this size to move at night, the trip to Idaho from Umatilla is planned to start tonight. The vehicle carrying the equipment is expected to block two-lane highways and is required to pull over every 5 to 7 miles should traffic need to get by. The company shipping the controversial load is called Omega Morgan and is based in Hillsboro. About 20 environmental activists protested at the port on Sunday, voicing their concerns about the equipment being used to extract dirty tar sands and contributing to global climate change. The Russian government has refused to comply with an international law of the sea's court order to release 30 Greenpeace activists and their ship. Instead, Russian officials say that they will proceed with trials for the activists, most of whom have now been released on bail. They are being charged with piracy and hooliganism for their nonviolent direct action in trying to stop an Arctic oil drilling operation. For more, Pacifica Radio spoke with a representative from Greenpeace International.
The activists have been released on bail, but they're not allowed to leave the country just yet because the trials are waiting to still to happen on whether they have committed what the prosecutors say they've committed, an act of hooliganism, and those trials are to be held within the next 2 months. For the time being, those activists are free, and those of them who are Russian citizens can go home and see their families, but the other ones will have to remain in Russia.
One of those released on bail was Captain Peter Wilcox, and he's been giving an interview of his account of events since his detention began.
That's right. An American, Peter Wilcox, who is the captain of the Arctic Sunrise ship, and he gave his first interview over the phone to the New York Times, and in that interview he described his detention and the jail time that followed. In that conversation he said the way the 30 activists were arrested in September was quite scary. He said about a dozen commandos descended on a ship wearing balaclavas, and they were armed with machine guns. He said they locked most of the crew members in their cabins and added that the first thing the commandos did was seizing everybody's alcohol and drinking it. He said that this could be linked to what is known as some sort of maritime tradition from the old days, when the first thing found on board by an invading crew was the rum.
What did Captain Wilcox say about the nature of his detention and the conditions he was kept in?
Peter Wilcox said that his detention was quite challenging, and he recalled a moment when he was contemplating whether he would spend another 10 years in Russia. Now, the city of Murmansk, where the activists were held, is located up north, and there's very little sunlight there at this time of the year. And that certainly didn't add to the living conditions in that jail. He said he was served fish head stew, which he enjoyed, but also cold mashed potatoes with herring, and that, he said, didn't quite go so well.
And can you tell me a bit about how this story, now rumbling on for 2 months, is being viewed in Russia? What's the reaction been where you are in Moscow?
The reaction to this case is very mixed in Russia, of course. There is a certain part of the society, I would say the majority of the society, which only gets what is shown on Russian state television. And they certainly share the official point of view, which is that the activists were not simply trying to protest oil drilling in the Arctic, but they tried to seize the platform. And that, as authorities say, endangered the lives of the people working there and created conditions that could result in a possible breakage of very sensitive equipment that is installed on that platform. But there is also another part of the society which says that the Russian response to this protest action is disproportionate, and that the people who were on board that ship need to be released as soon as possible.
That was a representative of Greenpeace International speaking with Pacifica Radio about the Russian government's decision to proceed with trials against 30 Greenpeace activists who tried to stop oil drilling in the Arctic.
A report by Essential Information in Washington has detailed the extent of corporate spying against nonprofit groups and individuals. For more, the author of the report, Spooky Business, Gary Ruskin, spoke with KBOO's Chris Andre.
So what we did in Spooky Business was we told the stories of 27 sets of corporate espionage against nonprofit organizations and activists. We found that this sort of corporate espionage has either been planned or executed by many of the world's largest companies and trade associations, like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Walmart, Monsanto, Bank of America, Dow Chemical, Kraft, Coca-Cola, Burger King, McDonald's, Chevron, Shell, BP, and others have been linked to espionage or planned espionage against nonprofit organizations. And we also see that many, many different types of nonprofit organizations have been targeted with espionage, including environmental, public interest, anti-war, consumer, food safety, pesticide reform, nursing home reform, gun control, social justice, animal rights, arms control groups have all been targeted with corporate espionage. And we found that, it's commonplace to see former intelligence, military, law enforcement, especially prevalent is the use of former CIA, former NSA, former Secret Service agents involved in corporate espionage against nonprofit organizations. So those are some of our major findings.
So what measures are nonprofits able to invoke to protect themselves?
Well, I mean, there are so many. Each one of these 30 stories is kind of a big story unto itself, and we
yes.
can probably talk about each one for a whole hour. So it's a little hard to just summarize. But yeah, I mean, in some cases the espionage has been magnificently complicated and diverse and intrusive on the inner workings of an organization. And so, you know, a good example of that would be Dow Chemical's espionage against Greenpeace USA. Which was very multifaceted and intrusive and where we found that they had done many types of intrusion and obtaining of many kinds of Greenpeace's phone records and internal memoranda, and were able to produce verbatim quotes from Greenpeace staff. There's that. So it's it can have a very, very large effect. But more generally, I mean, I think it's important to note that this kind of corporate espionage against nonprofit organizations is a threat to democracy, and it's a threat to individual privacy. It's a threat to democracy because democracy can't function without an effective civil society. But civil society and its nonprofit organizations depend crucially on their ability to keep some ideas and some information and conversations private until they're ready to make them public. And similarly, individual citizens and groups, we don't lose our right to privacy merely because we disagree with the activities or ideas of a corporation. And so that's why this is important.
The not-for-profit humanitarian OpenStreetMaps is the Wikipedia of up-to-the-minute geographic information. The group has been hard at work since Typhoon Haiyan hit the Philippines 2 weeks ago. They're trying to locate survivors and help with relief efforts. For more, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Skylar Earle, one of the organizers of the project.
The Humanitarian OpenStreetMap team is an international nonprofit organization that is dedicated to creating and applying open data, specifically open geographic data, for humanitarian purposes and for economic development around the world. The organization came together in its current form around the response to the earthquake in Port-au-Prince in Haiti 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago now. And we have an international team of volunteer collaborators who participate together over the internet to create a distributed database of geography that can be used to produce a map using the OpenStreetMap project. You can think of it as a sort of a Wikipedia for maps. And so we'll acquire and then trace satellite imagery or aerial imagery and identify buildings, roads, affected areas. And then this data can be used to produce maps that are then used by first responders on the ground who are working directly with people in affected areas.
So if I understand it approximately, it gives you a snapshot of what's happening right now in terms of different layers.
The thing, right, is that you can, there are certainly sources of maps available on the internet or even printed maps that are available to first responders, but they lack immediacy, right? By using the very latest aerial and satellite imagery and by using an international team of volunteers who are updating those maps in real time, we can provide first responders with the very latest information about the situation on the ground.
You mentioned the Wikipedia model, so does that imply wiki trolls?
It's interesting that you mentioned that. The OpenStreetMap community, right, which is a broader community that has been working for many years on the OpenStreetMap database, which is a global project and is not nearly limited to humanitarian assistance. They definitely, as a community, do have to grapple sometimes with people who have, less than constructive intent with regard to the process of collaborative mapping. But we have run into very few people who are so foolish or so cruel as to interfere with, what is ultimately a humanitarian effort. The bigger concern for us, actually, when we map populations that are affected by when we have areas that are affected by natural disasters, is that, mainly what we're trying to do is help people. And so we take care not to map anything that we might that we think might endanger the security of people who live in that area.
Right. I think some people might think the government ought to do what you're doing. Some people might think private corporations ought to do what you're doing. And what's this other way?
We have several advantages that both government and corporations don't have. I would say the biggest one is that we have a community of volunteers. When a disaster happens, right, you'll see an appeal, text a message to this phone number and donate $10 to the Red Cross. And for most of us, that's all we can do. Our hearts go out to people who are affected by crisis, but there's often very little that we ourselves can individually do. And the OpenStreetMap community, being in a position where we really can respond in a constructive way to a disaster using our technical skills and using the technical tools that we've developed over the years. It's really easy to get volunteers who have those technical skills and want to apply them because it's a thing that's actually constructive that they can jump in and do. And this is the existence of this volunteer community and the passion that we have for creating geographic information and for seeing that geographic data put to good use is a thing that neither governments nor corporations really have access to.
Free market is the best solution to every problem.
Well, we'd like to think that, but it hasn't really worked out so well for everybody in practice, has it? Yeah, I mean, the key thing, however, is that it is one thing that we do rely on are, you know, the safeguards of open source licensing and of the kind of the notion of copyright and of fair use, right? Because if we were not enabled by the internet and by, you know, the basic concept of open source licensing to produce this data on a collaborative basis, you know, then people might not do it. And so the idea of open culture and the idea of open source licensing is something that enables us to get people to participate because they know that the thing that they've produced through their efforts in mapping is something that is collectively owned and is produced for the collective good.
Right. What's the good news today?
The good news today. Well, the good news today, actually, I wish I had good news for you at the exact moment. You know, the humanitarian OpenStreetMap team, so far as I know, our maps are once again being pressed into service by, you know, both international and domestic organizations on the ground in the Philippines. I'm pleased to say that all of the contributors, all of our contributors in our community were not themselves directly affected by the storm and were able to pitch in and help out their countrymen. So there's that at least.
That was an organizer with the Humanitarian OpenStreetMap project, which is currently working on relief efforts in the Philippines, speaking with KBOO's Joe Meyer.
In a correction to our earlier story on the megaload shipment leaving Oregon tonight, the pound weight is actually 901,000 pounds instead of the initial 10,000 pounds, as was stated earlier. So again, 901,000 pounds. Police say a hoax may be responsible in the hours-long lockdown at Yale University, prompted by an anonymous tip alerting them to a supposed man with a gun headed to campus. Police officials in New Haven, Connecticut, where the campus is located, had ordered the lockdown a little before 10 a.m. local time when they received a call from a person saying their armed roommate intended to open fire at the school. A shelter-in-place order was sent out to Yale students, faculty, and staff as police conducted door-to-door searches for the gunman. The lockdown was lifted at 4:40 p.m. The matter is complicated by initial reports by multiple witnesses that say they saw an armed individual. Police spokesman David Hartman said the call came from a phone booth near campus and that the caller sounded like a confused gentleman. A deal has been reached in Geneva to limit the nuclear capabilities of Iran. For more, we go to Alice Olstein at Pacifica Radio in Washington.
Just days after President Obama announced the conditions of a deal to ensure Iran only uses its nuclear infrastructure for peaceful energy purposes, several members of Congress and international allies panned the deal, calling it dangerous and a mistake. But other world leaders and experts are praising the accord as a historic first step toward a lasting deal to limit and monitor Iran's nuclear program. Lee C. Healy with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation said the agreement made in Geneva this past weekend, quote, stops Iran's nuclear program in its tracks.
It essentially stops all of Iran's 20% enrichment. They will blend down all of their 20% enriched uranium. It puts caps on their lower enriched uranium. It stops the installation of more centrifuges in their facilities, and it stops their facility at their plutonium facility at Iraq that had a lot of concern surrounding it in the last stages of these negotiations. So this is a really, really great deal. It also puts the most intrusive inspections regime ever negotiated into place. Iran will be subject to daily inspections on its nuclear facilities, ensuring that the international community can make sure that it's not building a nuclear weapon. And that's much more than we've ever had before.
The partner nations will resume negotiations with Iran almost immediately to try to hammer out a permanent deal in the next 6 months. The United States and the European Union will also begin lifting some of the economic sanctions on Iran as early as December. He Haley explained that the sanctions relief in the temporary agreement will mostly benefit middle-class Iranian civilians.
The specific measures focus primarily on airplane parts, airplane safety, transportation, and student visas overseas. Students have been strongly affected by these sanctions. So the sanctions relief on the table right now focuses on taking some of that pressure off of the people, because the pressure should be on the Iranian regime. The pressure should be on the nuclear program and not on the people.
The sanctions against Iran's oil exports and participation in international banking will remain in place for now, but could be eased in a final agreement. In a speech late Saturday night, President Obama thanked Congress for upholding these sanctions for many years, but pleaded with them not to vote on additional measures to punish Iran while the sensitive negotiations are still underway.
Over the last few years, Congress has been a key partner in imposing sanctions on the Iranian government, and that bipartisan effort made possible the progress that was achieved today. Going forward, we will continue to work closely with Congress. However, now is not the time to move forward on new sanctions, because doing so would derail this promising first step, alienate us from our allies, and risk unraveling the coalition that enabled our sanctions to be enforced in the first place.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has said that if there are new sanctions from the U.S., the deal is off. But many members of Congress are still calling for additional sanctions. In a statement released over the weekend, Florida Republican Marco Rubio wrote, quote, "There is now an even more urgent need for Congress to increase sanctions until Iran completely abandons its enrichment and reprocessing capabilities." Some members of the president's own party agree. New York Democrat Charles Schumer called the interim deal disproportionate and said he is currently discussing additional sanctions with his colleagues. Because these and other lawmakers have vowed to continue pushing for sanctions when they return to work in early December, Healy said it's crucial for the U.S. public to weigh in now if they want to support a peaceful deal and prevent an armed conflict. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, November 25th, 2013. Israeli troops kidnapped 12 civilians during morning invasions starting in West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. On Monday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded dozens of communities in different parts of the occupied West Bank, broke into and violently searched homes, and kidnapped at least 12 Palestinians. Local sources reported that Israeli army invasions targeted the southern West Bank city of Hebron and nearby village and kidnapped 5 residents, among them 2 children. In the nearby Bethlehem city, soldiers searched and ransacked homes on Monday and kidnapped 4 civilians. 3 more civilians were kidnapped during an Israeli army invasion targeting the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Soldiers fired several concussion grenades, flares, gas bombs, and rubber-coated metal bullets during clashes with local youth who hurled stones at them during the invasion. In other news, the Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu has decided to build and legalize more than 800 units in illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. The decision came just a few days after the Netanyahu government decided to halt the planning of 20,000 units in Jewish settlements in occupied West Bank and occupied Jerusalem in the current phase. The Higher Planning Council of the Civil Administration Unit run by the army in the occupied territories has decided to build 365 units in the Nafha Farat illegal outpost in the Gosh Etzion settlement block, despite the fact that the outpost is illegal under Israeli law and was repeatedly evicted. All Israeli settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem are illegal under international law. Israel decided to legalize the outpost and expand it to turn it into a settlement enjoying all services. The Netanyahu government further decided to build 30 units in Shiloh settlement and legalize 19 units in the Giv'at Shalit settlement in the Jordan Valley, in addition to approving the construction of 94 units on 168 dunums, 23 acres of land. Additional 409 units were approved in Giv'at Ze'ev settlement, northwest of Jerusalem, and additional 12 illegal units were legalized in Nukudim settlement, where Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman lives. The Palestinian Presidency spokesperson, Nabila Bourdaina, from his part said that the decision to construct additional 800 units in occupied Palestine proves Israel is interested in escalating and it's preventing direct peace talks from achieving any positive development. Internally, Palestinian sources have reported that Palestinian security men and gunmen exchanged fire in Balata refugee camp east of the northern West Bank city of Nablus. The sources said that the security forces went into the camp and fired gas bombs at dozens of local youth who burned tires and tried to prevent them from advancing. Eyewitnesses stated that both sides fired dozens of rounds of live ammunition. No casualties have been reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, November 25th, 2013 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Genevieve McDaniels, Mike Klepfer, Peter Shoaff, and Joe Meyer. The producer is Ross Freeman-Levin, with special thanks to Jimmy Tardy and Chris Andre. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Shanka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews.
If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issues you've heard on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Frances Fagan. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodwin and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Abe and Joe Show, host Joe Uris interviews a Navy veteran who experienced sexual abuse at the hands of an officer and fought to get compensation and justice. At 9, on Alternative Radio, journalist and labor immigrant rights activist David Bacon speaks on migration and U.S. policy. And at 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre.
At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, guest host S.W. Conser interviews Penny Allen, who helped kickstart Portland's independent film scene in the 1970s, hiring budding talents Eric Edwards, Gus Van Sant, and Henrik Ponder to work on iconic features such as Property and Pay Dirt. And at 11:30 on Art Focused, host Joseph Gallivan interviews the photographer Isaac Lehman, whose work is showing in the Portland Art Museum as part of the 2013 Contemporary Northwest Art Awards. Lehman is known for the large digital photo compositions based on everyday objects.
Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Good night, John.
Good night, Francis.
This Tuesday at 8 a.m. on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, we'll talk with a Navy veteran who experienced sexual abuse at the hands of an officer and who fought long and hard to get compensation and justice. All this and more on Call-In Radio, Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, this Tuesday, 8 a.m. This Tuesday.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
KBOO is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KBOO's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KBOO jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
At KBOO, we have a dynamic community of